Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. I'm Don Marsh. What makes St. Louis Public Radio's We Live Here podcast a special reflection of our region? We'll find out from reporter-producers Camille Stanley and Tim Lloyd a little bit later. But first, when we consider the influence of immigrants in our region, we'll likely focus on the French, Germans, and Irish. But another group shares historic relevance, the Spanish. Over the centuries, hundreds of thousands of Spaniards have come to this country playing many different kinds of roles. But the Spanish influence here and elsewhere is often understated. Our first guests want to change that and acknowledge the waves of Spanish immigrants who came from the mid-19th to the mid-20th centuries. They do so in a book rich in what amounts to historic photos and snapshots titled Invisible Immigrants, Spaniards in the U.S., 1848-1945. Joining me in studio, New York University professor Dr. James Fernandez and Spanish author and filmmaker Luis Agreo. Gentlemen, thanks so much for being with us. Nice to have you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, Jim, let me start with you, if I may. Why do we call them invisible?
Well, as you mentioned, this is an episode in immigration history in the U.S. which is pretty much unknown outside the community itself. Compared to Italians and Irish and German, the numbers of Spaniards who came here in this period are very small. We're talking about tens of thousands as opposed to hundreds of thousands or even millions. And we think that they're invisible also because most people in the U.S., if they do know anything about Spaniards and the United States, they think about friars, missionaries, conquistadores, explorers, that much earlier imperial period of Spanish history, when there's this other chapter that really is invisible and unknown, which is part of the much larger story of immigrants in general. These are working class people and peasants who, like the Irish and Italians and Germans, leave terrible conditions to look for a better future in this country.
I should point out, and I mentioned this to you before we went on the air, I had a communication via Facebook today from a gentleman who said, be sure to point out that the cities of St. Augustine and Santa Fe were established by the Spaniards long before Jamestown was founded.
That's
so
right.
Spaniards have been here for a good long while. Mm-hmm. Luis, why did you want to get into this?
Well, I have personal connections with this this chapter of the history. I have in my family, part of my family came here to the States as a looking for works. They were exactly to West Virginia to work on the zinc mills, but also to St. Louis. Some brothers of my grandmother on my father's side came to St. Louis looking for a job on these factories here.
That was the driving force, I guess, throughout the period that we're talking about, the middle 19th century to the middle of this century.
Exactly. It was all about labor.
Yeah. The zinc mills that Luis just mentioned, that was a draw for them to this part of the country as well. I frankly wasn't aware that we had much in the way of zinc mines in this part of the country.
Yeah, well, we've learned that on both sides of the river there were important zinc works in the earliest decades of the 20th century. And it turns out that in the part of Spain that Luis is from, and my grandfather is also from that same part of Spain, there was a major zinc works in place that was experiencing all kinds of labor strife and strikes and shutdowns. And that kind of sparked this exodus of semi-skilled zinc workers from Asturias to wherever there was zinc in the U.S. We've learned this. We have a map of what we call the zinc circuit. Wherever there's zinc in the United States, there are Spaniards, and more specifically Spaniards from the northern region of Asturias. So we find them in West Virginia. We find them in Peoria, in Cherryvale, Kansas, here in St. Louis and East St. Louis.
Canton, Ohio,
Donora, Pennsylvania. Unlikely places, but the connection is the zinc work.
Luis, did the zinc work require special skills? Is that why they sought it?
Yeah, I think so. They used to tell us, you know, all the descendants of that immigrants, that they were very qualified workers because they could they could stand the heat in front of you know, inside of these factories. They were coming with all these with their methods of work. So they were, we could say they were experts working, and they need to cooperate a lot. So probably language was also important. If you can communicate with your partners working mm-hmm. on the in front of a big oven, you need to talk with them and you need to understand what they are saying. So they used to come here, the whole family or neighbors, and they came from, like James was saying, they came from factories pretty similar to the factories that they found here. So. Mm.
Jim Fernandez, as you've indicated, this is really the story of all the waves of immigrants that came through. They would band together because of language and custom and all the rest of it.
Right. Yeah, it's hard for us to imagine these years before the New Deal, before Social Security, unemployment, Medicare, Medicaid. Immigrants that came to this country had to band together to create their own safety net. There was no government safety net. And all of the immigrants from all of the nationalities formed clubs and mutual aid societies precisely to have this safety net for the community. And the Spaniards were no different. There's a Spanish society brick building in the Carondelet neighborhood of St. Louis that was built in 1929 and is still standing, and we're going to go there on Friday to a Spanish reunion. And this was a mutual aid society built to help the immigrants get through the Depression and maintain their traditions and language.
Do you have any sense of how large a Spanish community we have here in St. Louis, and is it one that is contained in a particular area?
Well, our sense right now is that they're quite spread out.
Yeah.
But back in the day, they were concentrated in that area of Carondelet. Is that how we say
Carondelet.
It? Carondelet.
Yes. So they don't pronounce it with the French pronunciation.
So that was the earliest Spanish neighborhood was in the Carondelet area. And the Spanish club is on Michigan Avenue in that part of town. And then on the east side of the river in East St. Louis and Fairmont and later Granite City. I guess the zinc work was translatable to steel work and other chemical jobs too. So they did branch out to other industries. But zinc was what they knew, and that's what brought them here.
Of course, Granite City
we could say that they could be hundreds of families. Back then, but I don't know. 2,000. I mean, there were quite a few.
Right. Well, the steel mills over in Granite City are quite well known and have been a big part of that community for a long, long time. Jim, you mentioned a moment ago that mutual aid was part of the process and part of what was going on with these groups as they came over. And it's interesting because you're relying on a form of mutual aid, we're relying on it, to publish your book.
Yeah, it's a beautiful part of this story. When we decided, Luis and I have been working independently for 10 years now and together for 5 on this project, trying to figure out who the Spaniards were that came here and how they got here and what they did once they were here. And for the last 5 years, we've been working together, and our method of working is basically to identify descendants of Spanish immigrants, to try to get invited into their homes, to look at their family archives, and to film oral history interviews. And as a result of that process, we've traveled all over the country. We've been in California and Pennsylvania, New York, Florida, New Jersey, and now in Missouri and Illinois. We have an archive of now roughly 10,000 scanned photographs of the personal, intimate lives of these immigrants. And I guess about 2 years ago, we decided it was time to put something out there, to publish some of this work, to make a little bit of a splash. And we thought a picture book would be the way to do it. And so we also, along the way, we created a Facebook page for this project, which at first I didn't know too much about Facebook. And I did it because a young research assistant said this project needs a Facebook page. But Facebook has turned out to be a key research tool for us. Our Facebook page has almost 9,000 followers now, and it's a constant source of new information and of new contacts. So we had this archive of photographs, and we had this network of several thousand people who had self-identified as being interested in this story. And we realized that we could use new platforms and new ways of doing things to produce this book. In other words, we spoke to publishers in Spain and we said – we showed them the pictures. We told them the story. We told them we had a ready-made community of 8,000 potential buyers, and they were all over it. They would have loved to do it. But and they immediately started talking about this community that we've helped form as a market. And both Luis and I came out of one meeting feeling dirty, like, you know, this is not a market. We haven't done this work to build a market for a publisher to make a book.
We have a community.
And so we thought, how can we produce this work in the spirit of a community project? And, you know, the miracle of crowdfunding and Kickstarter is there precisely for this kind of effort. So we, on the Facebook page, we said, you guys have shared your lives with us. You've shared your photographs with us. We'd like to produce a beautiful coffee table book, you know, very carefully produced that gets the story out there. Help us out. Help us fund this project. We need X amount of dollars, and we'd like, you know, Kickstarter makes you put a end date. So from September 15th to October 15th of last year, we had this campaign to raise the money that we would need to produce the book. And as you say, along the way, we realized that this crowdfunding is precisely what the immigrants did anytime they needed to do anything. If they wanted to buy a trophy for the soccer tournament, they'd crowdfund. They didn't call it that. If they needed to send a compatriot home because he was ill and wanted to die in the homeland, they would do a collection. So, yeah, we were repeating the structure and the process.
Yeah. Luis, will there be a film as a result of all of this?
Well, we also filmed we tried to make interviews, first of all, use that interviews or those interviews as put them on the archive, mm-hmm. and create a big archive of not only with pictures but also with the interviews of the actual owners of the pictures, right? The descendants. But so we are finding from time to time, we find also people that want to participate a little bit farther and they led us to direct them, you know, as with using filming language.
Sure.
So we create these documentary films to put them also on the archive and attract different space. I mean, go with the documentary films to film festivals or to college, universities, or find different spots to talk about the project, the big project, mm-hmm. that is this online archive of this investigation.
Right? Yeah. By the way, I should point out that some of the photos from your book, from your Facebook page, are being distributed right now by us via Twitter to bring it to the people's attention. I have to take a break now. We'll do that. My guests in studio are New York University professor Dr. James Fernandez and Spanish author and filmmaker Luis Agrayo, authors of Invisible Immigrants. They're going to be appearing tomorrow night at the Missouri History Museum at 7 o'clock, by the way. They'll be talking more about their project and about the Spanish community in the St. Louis area. Back to continue the conversation in just a moment. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KW. WMU. And welcome back as we continue our conversation with Jim Fernandez and Luis Agrayo, authors of Invisible Immigrants. Luis mentioned just during that break, by the way, you have three films now that have actually resulted from this project.
That's it. So far we have three. We made the first – well, I made the first in West Virginia with also descendants of zinc workers. And second one, we made it together. And it took us to California to investigate the roots of the immigrants who came through Hawaii Islands and settled in Monterey, California, to work on the canneries and fish as a fisherman. Mm-hmm. And the third one is a legacy of a smoke settled in Tampa, Florida, mm-hmm. with all the workers throughout the cigar industry who came through Cuba, from also from most of them from the north part of Spain, Galicia and Asturias too.
You know, I referred to, in the introduction, referred to the many of the photos in the book as snapshots. And that's precisely what they are. These are not a lot of formal portraiture in the book.
Yeah. I think that's one of the strengths of the book, that it really does give an intimate – these are pictures that no one else has seen beyond the family. And they do give a sense of the daily life of the immigrants themselves. There are – when the immigrants had enough money to go to a photo studio, they would go. Very often – photo studios had wardrobes where they could put on the not their finest, but the finest that the studio had. And most of those pictures we found were taken to be sent back to Spain so that they could create a great impression about how great things are, even if they were in borrowed clothes.
But, what yeah. I'm sorry. What was life like for them? Give me a sense of what life was like for these people, the first generation and during their early times here.
Well, I think for the men, it was work, work, work. They came here to work and to save money. We found that, like most immigrant groups then and probably always, they dreamt about going back to Spain. Some of the descendants don't realize this or they don't remember it this way. But we, by studying family archives, we've learned that most of them come with the hope of making some money, that things will get better in Spain and they'll be able to go back. So the men worked, and the women also worked tremendously, but it was basically factory work that drove the process. So it was a lot of work, and in their spare time, they often used these clubs and mutual aid societies as the place to organize their social life. It was the place of the picnic and of the soccer tournament and courtship rituals so that the young men would marry young women in the same group. They would have dances and all kinds of activities.
So, of course, Luis, they maintained as much of the culture of their native culture as they possibly could.
Yeah, because they didn't want to cut the contact with their country and their mm-hmm. families there. They left a lot of relatives there. The only thing that had this dream of returning, of going back to their places was the Spanish Civil War. And that's the point that Jim was mentioned that put the distance between the opportunity to stay here or the dream of going back.
This was 1936 to 1939.
That's
the Spanish Civil War.
That's it.
What about at the turn of the century? I mean, there was another little, the Spanish-American War was also a part of that history. How did that impact the Spanish people who were here?
Most of the immigration happens shortly after that war. Uh-huh. And this is a little known fact. Even in Spain, immigration from Spain to the Americas, Central and South and North America, accelerates after Spain loses its last colonies. In part because that loss of the colonies created a terrible economic depression in the country and things got really dire. And so millions of Spaniards leave for Argentina, Mexico, Uruguay, and countries in Spanish-speaking America. And really the large part of our story happens after 1898. And then the Spanish Civil War, which is just a few decades later, really does mark – it's amazing – in the family albums, we can see almost every family album has and family story has a before and after. Because when an immigrant family is here dreaming about going back to Spain, making sure that your children speak Spanish is crucial. And the fact, you know, making sure that they learn English is almost, they don't worry too much about that because we're only here for some years. Mm-hmm. But in 1936, when that war ends and the country's in ruins and there's a fascist dictatorship in place, most of these people know that they're not going back. And you can see it in the family stories that concern about keeping Spanish alive in the kids becomes less important. And you see more assimilation, the parents encourage the kids to learn English faster, to get more involved in American activities, even sports.
Luis, what sort of influence did these Spanish immigrants have on Americans in terms of they've certainly brought certain things with them that were adopted or quickly taken up by the people who are here?
We are hearing that they were very hard working people. Mm-hmm. I don't know if that could be an influence bringing from that immigrants.
Well, I'm thinking more like food,
and
customs that kind of were adopted by the Americans because they liked them. They found them charming. Well, they found them interesting.
We can say that we enjoyed yesterday a very good garbanzo soup made by this kind, made by a wonderful woman, Marlene Suarez. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure if we could find this kind of soup here in San Luis, maybe with some ribs or, but of course, food has been very important as a cultural mark that brought that.
How about music?
Music too. We have a wonderful picture that could tell us about the trip that made throughout instruments. They brought the Spanish guitar. They went to Hawaii and they found the ukulele. And finally, they came to the country, to the United States, and they knew the banjo. So we have a family with the three instruments, with three brothers, with three instruments that probably sounds really good together.
Yeah, well, and flamenco music has always been popular here, at least as long as I've been alive.
Yeah, there's something really interesting that happens in this context. We found, that these immigrants are from the periphery of Spain for the most part, and their ties to Spain and Spanish culture are kind of tenuous. Huh. They think of themselves more as being from Asturias or from Galicia or from their region. And they come to this country where, first of all, large swaths of the country had been settled and colonized by Spaniards. So Spaniards arrive to a country where there are cities and streets and rivers named in their native language, which must have been a weird experience. And they have to learn how to pronounce them in English.
English. Sure.
San Francisco is San Francisco. Mm. And also they experience the importation into the U.S. of certain fads like music and food and things that they're not really responsible for. The cultural forms come from other venues, right? And yet they're Spaniard and have to deal with it. So we've heard stories of people saying, a Spaniard being told you're not Spanish enough because you don't do flamenco, but Northern Spain doesn't listen to flamenco.
Well, there are a number of good tapas restaurants in the St. Louis area you might want to explore while you're here.
We'd love to.
We have a call that fits right into this part of the conversation. Let's bring in Colleen. Doesn't sound too Spanish to me, but Colleen has a story for us. Go ahead.
Hi.
Hi.
Yes. Hi. My name is Colleen. My father is an Irish-American, of Irish-American descent, and he was actually born in 1927. And lived in the Cronlett neighborhood. And I just wanted to speak to your question about the influence of the Spanish on the other people of other backgrounds who were in that same area there. And my father actually picked up the sport of soccer from all his Spanish buddies on the playground at Blow School. Excuse my voice, by the way. Blow School playground. And made, very, very lifelong friendships, learned the language of Spanish. And then he ended up, my father being St. Louis University's soccer coach and playing on the national team for the United States in the Olympics. And so this is all from the Spanish kids in the neighborhood through the influence of soccer and great friendships.
Colleen, what was your father's name?
Harry Keough.
Harry Keough, of course. Well, my, that's a very famous name in St. Louis and Midwestern soccer. And we owe much of his success, I take it, to the Spaniards.
He does. He and his older brother, Bill, picked it up first. He was 10 years older than my father. And they absolutely loved all their Spanish friends. And that passed on, to us. And so And interestingly and coincidentally, my father ended up marrying a Mexican woman. So we were brought up speaking Spanish, but my father loved the Irish name. So we got very Irish names were given to us, even though we're half Mexican.
I think we have a picture of your father.
We do have a picture of your father in our archive.
Yeah.
Standing next to...
Is that right?
Yeah. Tom Garcia.
Tom Garcia from Asturias gave us a picture.
Of course.
Do you know him?
I remember. Well, my father spoke so often about all of his friends, all his Spanish friends, except one funny thing he always talked about. They all had nicknames.
Because yeah.
He said at one period of time in his neighborhood, there were like 24 guys, I think this is right, with the name Jose Menendez, maybe, and they all had nicknames. I mean, there was, you know, Fernandez is one name. Chick Fernandez was the gentleman who actually, Chicago, I think, was his nickname.
Chicago, anyway, yeah, yeah, we know
this
him.
This is an
yeah,
example yeah. of million. Sophie was named, Moco, Boobs, you know, I mean, there are all these
true,
he
true.
He would just talk about them constantly and tell all the stories. So we appreciate our, you know, the connection and what the Spanish friends and my father brought to our family and in the neighborhood and culture, you know, in a wider way.
Colleen, thank you so much for the call and for bringing that story to us. Great to hear
You're
the name.
Welcome.
Great to hear the name Harry Keough again, a famous
you made
one
my
here.
Day. Thank you.
Thank you for calling. It's a small world, isn't it?
Oh, wow. I'm surprised. I'm shocked now. Because we have the picture.
Well, he said, this is my dad next to a really famous soccer player from St. Louis.
This is not in the book. This is part of your archive.
I think it didn't make it into the book.
Yeah. I'm not sure, no.
I have a baseball story, if I can tell
very quickly.
But from Denora, Pennsylvania, the home place of Stan Musial.
Sure.
I was reading a biography of Stan Musial, and it talked about how his earliest coach and mentor was this Spanish guy who worked the night shift at the zinc factory and was free during the days to give kids batting lessons and coaching. I think he was his first manager in a semi-professional team named Barbao was the last name. But it's a Spanish zinc worker had a little role in Stan Musial's development as a baseball player.
Well, as I say, it's a small world. And once you start connecting the dots, it's amazing where it will all take you, isn't it?
Yeah.
Gentlemen, I want to thank you so much for being with us. New York University professor Jim Fernandez, great to have you with us. And Spanish author and filmmaker Luis Agrayo. They are the authors of Invisible Immigrants, a reminder that they're going to be appearing at the Missouri History Museum tomorrow evening at 7 o'clock. We'll talk more about that and maybe connect a few more dots here in St. Louis. Mm-hmm. Thank you, gentlemen, for being with us.
Thank you very much.
Enjoy your stay in St. Louis. I'll give you the name of a good tapas restaurant, by the way.
Thanks so much.
Coming up, We Live Here, where it's been and where it's going. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU.